Hello and thanks for tuning in to the Fisheries Podcast. We are extremely excited to announce that we have officially launched our Fisheries Podcast fan shop page over on teespring.com, where you can choose from a variety of different fish radio wave patterns on a t-shirt, hoodie, or sticker. Everything from anglerfish, sharks, and even your friendly catfish. So head on over, check out the shop, and sport the Fisheries Podcast new apparel. And without further ado, here is my interview with Hank Hershey. Thank you for joining me. I am Brett Kelly, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, be sure to follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. If you enjoy the show and would like to become a sponsor, please head over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast, where for as little as $1 a month, you can help out the show and receive a Fisheries Podcast sticker in the mail. For $10 a month, you can receive a Fisheries Podcast hat, a sticker, and then additionally, you will be the official sponsor of the final closing questions that we ask each of our guests. And at our premier level, for $20 a month, you'll receive all the merch mentioned before, plus be the official sponsor of each episode's guest or interview. But of course, remember that regardless of if you become a sponsor or not, we really appreciate you guys listening to the show. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking to another fellow Team Fish member, Hank Hershey. Hank is currently working on his PhD at Auburn University, studying the energetic costs of fish passage in the Southeast using various types of telemetry. His master's research, also at Auburn University, described the behavior and passage costs of paddlefish at a Lowhead Dam in the Alabama River. He has a biology degree from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, and has worked in Alaska and Ireland. In addition to being a fish squeezer, Hank enjoys teaching art studio workshops for beginner or advanced programmers, and he is also an illustrator, designer, and an avid fly fisherman devoted to the pursuit, promotion, and protection of native sport fishes. And without any further ado, welcome to the show, Hank.
Hey, Brett. Thanks for having me.
So, you're calling in from Alabama, but where is it that you consider home? Because I'm from South Carolina, and I feel that it can be interesting to see how people from different regions think about fisheries management issues or conservation issues.
I grew up in New Jersey. Went to high school there, but I was born in Belgium. My mother's Belgian and my dad's American, and we moved to the States when I was about three, so I lost the language at a young age, but we went back all the time, and I sort of consider myself an international citizen. But yeah, I guess, you know, my roots are in New Jersey.
So your research at Auburn is focused on the energetic costs of different fishes in relation to like fish passage and movement. So what are some things recently that you've been finding out from the results of stuff you've been working on?
There have been some pilot projects that preceded our study on fish passage in the river. The Geological Survey, the Army Corps of Engineers, and actually a predecessor of mine, Brandon Simcox, who's now in Tennessee, they tagged a whole bunch of different fish, and they saw them swimming over this dam, Claiborne Locken Dam. It's the lowermost impoundment on the Alabama River. So they knew that certain species were capable of passing the dam. What our project is trying to do is sort of get at questions of how much does it take to get over the dam, how often are they able to get over, and then certain, you know, fine scale movement behaviors to see, you know, are there certain staging areas that are important for them in the tail race, and are there certain paths that they can take over the dam that are a little bit more efficient, because how long it takes you to get past a barrier can have pretty big impacts on your chance at spawning success, reaching your spawning grounds under the right conditions, and that can then have implications for egg survival. So we're trying to look at things from a population scale But to do that, we're investigating these really fine scale behaviors with acoustic telemetry.
That's pretty neat. I guess one of the maybe precedents for starting the project in general, was there any declining trends of certain fish in the system or in the state or anything like that?
Yeah, so Alabama has one of the largest river systems in the U.S. The Mobile Basin is enormous. It's got thousands and thousands of river miles. And until the construction of dams, there were a lot of anadromous species that used to come up to the fall line, and some even going past the fall line upstream. So we used to have, there are these amazing pictures of people catching Gulf sturgeon in Birmingham, but those days are long gone. Alabama has experienced some of the worst declines in migratory fishes in the Gulf Coast because we have so many impoundments. We still have a few refuges, I guess. We have a few unimpounded rivers like the Choctahatchee, which is separate from the Mobile Basin, where there are still decent populations of species like the Gulf sturgeon and Alabama shad. But the species that we work on are not anadromous. They're potamadromous, so they migrate only in freshwater. There's some evidence that our species are using the delta, which is brackish, depending on the freshwater input from the Mobile River. But so, yeah, I mean, Alabama's experienced pretty severe declines in all of its migratory fish species, but the ones we work on, they're not in the worst shape. Paddlefish are still doing pretty well. We don't really have a lot of information about the populations of smallmouth buffalo, but we've never captured the same fish twice in a net, and we're out there all the time. So we have pretty good reason to believe that the populations are healthy. And unfortunately, you know, we'd like to study the Alabama sturgeon, which is critically endangered in the state, but the last time anyone saw one was in 2007. So it would be hard to get our hands on one of those to tag it. We know they're still there because we have environmental DNA for the species as recently as, I think, 2014. Don't quote me on that, but there are certain animals that are so rare that you can't study them because you could never find them. But we think, you know, that the dams had extreme impacts on those species, as well as overfishing. There was pretty high commercial harvests back in the day, and especially for the sturgeon species, which are extremely valuable for their eggs. And paddlefish, too. Paddlefish saw some declines in Alabama, but after much more restricted management from the state, you know, those fish were able to make a bit of a comeback. And we think that they're still reproducing because, you know, we're sampling fish between the impoundments that are younger than 25. So that, although it is a long-lived fish, they were still spawning after the dams went in. So there's still pretty decent recruitment for most of the fish that we work on. But unfortunately, overall, there have been severe declines in a lot of the migratory fish species in Alabama.
It's good that there's still hope and that you guys are finding recruitment. I know when I was working in South Carolina, the Savannah River watershed, which has a couple of species of sturgeon, or maybe just the Atlantic, and then also like striper populations that would be anadromous and moving up and down, you know, those species have taken a huge hit by, you know, all the large reservoirs along the Savannah River watershed. But did you guys obtain data passively, or did you have to go out and track all these fish?
So the transmitters we use are combined acoustic and radio. So we can manually track them with the radio antenna, or we can passively track them with stationary acoustic receivers. We do both depending on the questions we're asking. We maintain a receiver array, you can call it, that's about 100 river kilometers long, up and downstream of Claiborne Lock and Dam. And those receivers are constantly pinging fish moving up and down as they migrate. But we use the radio antennas to try to get better estimates of where those fish are at certain times of year and depending on a project. So for example, there's a guy in our lab, Daniel Thomas, whose project was to basically assess the feasibility of translocating paddlefish and a few other species upstream of the dam. So he was doing a trap and haul procedure where he would catch a bunch of paddlefish at the same time, throw them in a live well, lock up through the dam, drive a couple kilometers upstream, and then he'd tag them and release them. And then for a month after that, he would go at different intervals and manually track those fish. So with the manual tracking, you've got a better chance at finding all the fish that you tagged. With passive tracking, it can be sometimes difficult if fish are kind of hunkering down between the receivers or sort of just out of range. But with manual tracking, you have a better chance at finding all of your fish.
Nice. Yeah, we have a couple of folks here at Iowa State that do both of those things for some reservoir walleye populations throughout the state. So I was kind of curious. One of the things we like to do within our department is try and highlight fieldwork wins or fieldwork fails. And actually, they're highlighted in a publication that we circulate just within our department. But any notable fieldwork fails or fieldwork wins you'd like to report?
Oh, so many. Well, I'll say a fieldwork fail first, and then I'll try to think of a win. We were filling up a live well in the bed of a truck at the bottom of the boat ramp, so that we could haul some fish back to campus for swimming performance studies in the wet lab. And so we had a bunch of these freshwater drum in the live well. We're filling it up with some more water, and another guy in the lab jumps out of the truck, and the door shuts behind him, and the truck's running, but the door was locked because he had hit the little lock thing jumping out of the truck. So now we're at the bottom of this boat ramp with the live well full of fish, and there's bass boats like backed up all the way up the boat ramp trying to get down. And we're sitting there. We have no idea how to get back into the truck. It didn't have automatic locks on it. So we had to call a guy, and then we didn't have cell service. So it took about 3 hours for us to get back into the truck and get those fish home, but they all made it. And luckily there's another boat ramp just upstream of the dam that the bass guys could use. But we were definitely not anybody's friend that day.
Yeah, don't mess with bass fishermen. Not in the Southeast, for sure.
It was worse because we've got Auburn written all over our trucks and boats, and everybody out there is an Alabama fan, so they just rag on you. So
typical Auburn. They're just yelling Roll Tide as they flip you the bird.
Exactly.
So any wins to balance out the scale there?
You know, honestly, just like getting a receiver is a win in our system. Our system is so volatile that, you know, you never know if you're going to go back for a receiver and it's still going to be there. Sometimes you drive 40 river miles to where you think a receiver is supposed to be at, and then you pull up the anchor and the cable's snapped off, or it's rusted out, or more often than not, they're still there because we have some pretty heavy duty stuff. But I remember one time there was a boat ramp that was closed, so we had to go an extra 40 miles down to our receiver station to collect this receiver. And of course we pulled up the anchor and it wasn't there. So we looked around a little bit to see if it was nearby, didn't see any sign of it. And this was just after a huge high water event. And so we decided to go back. As we're motoring upstream, we're kind of feeling pretty bad, but it pays to look up because 20 feet up in a tree was our receiver hanging there from a buoy in the branches, and we were able to get it down and get the data off of it and redeploy it. So
I'd say that's a win. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's kind of a win.
Wow. That's incredible. I guess needless to say, that system receives large amounts of discharge and water coming down through there.
Yeah. It's a big river with all the dams on. You'd sort of think that the hydrograph would be a little bit more regulated, but with all the water they get, they have to be constantly releasing. So we get really peaky hydrographs, especially in the spring and in the early fall. Those are two kind of big rainy seasons. It's great for the fish because our dam gets inundated and they can just go straight over the top. But it's really hard to study them when they do that because our receivers in that environment don't usually perform the way we want them to.
A lot of noise.
So yeah, there's a lot of noise immediately against the dam because of the, you know, air entrainment, the bubble entrainment from the turbulence and everything. But when we can keep our receivers working and keep the batteries alive, we get some pretty cool data out of that.
So I guess a bit of a left turn, but something I definitely wanted to touch on because it seemed like a pretty unique experience, and something that not a lot of folks that come on the show maybe have, is that you mentioned that you worked in Ireland. So what kind of work or project were you involved with in Ireland?
I was studying abroad over there, and I volunteered with a professor named Tom Reed, who actually did a postdoc at University of Washington with Tom Quinn and Dan Schindler. But he's a salmon biologist, and he studies the phenology and life history of juvenile salmon. At the time, he was trying to figure out what environmental factors influence the rates of precocious maturation in juvenile salmon. So what, and brown trout. So what makes juveniles mature earlier and not migrate out to sea. So I was just helping him raise fish in an aquarium, and they have a pretty decent sized aquaculture unit there. And so I was raising salmon smolts for him, and he invited me to come to lectures and things like that. And it was just a really cool experience. I didn't get to do any field work, but it was awesome to be able to help with that project and have Tom as a colleague and a mentor. He's been really, really great to work with.
Any environmental factors of note that influence that early maturation?
I was on the project at a very early stage, so they hadn't yet gotten any data, and actually I haven't been updated on that. So I should email him.
Well, your bio also mentions that you like to teach, or you're involved with, you know, the instruction of some RStudio workshops, which is definitely really increasingly popular software for environmental science, all sorts of things. Is that sponsored by Auburn, or is that an AFS thing, or how did you get involved with that?
So I had a colleague here named Ben Staten, who has since graduated. He finished his PhD last year and is now in Oregon, but he is an R whiz, and he has done some pretty stout statistical modeling. And so he was basically the guy in our lab who, whenever you had a question about stats or R, you always went to him. And I came to him with a project from before I arrived at Auburn, and we did some coding with that, and he invited me to help him teach his workshop, which was Introduction to R using RStudio. And that worked out, and he just basically kept inviting me to come help him teach at stuff. And so far I've co-instructed a lot with him, and this past week I was at the Southern Division meeting teaching from those materials from his workshop to professionals at Southern Division. Brian Irwin, he's a professor at UGA. He got us the time slot for the workshop, and then I said, hey, I've got all these materials we can use, and we all kind of tag teamed it, and people seem to enjoy it. So we don't really get into the more advanced modeling techniques, but for a lot of people, it's useful just to see how R works, and then they can expand for their own uses.
Last semester actually was the first time that another department that we are somewhat associated with offered a data science in R class. And I found a lot of value in having a semester long class. That way there's more dedicated time to it. But those workshops are pretty helpful as well.
The longer those workshops are, usually the better the outcomes are, just because you get a lot of practice, and you don't really learn it until you really start to mess with your own data.
So you've answered some of the tough questions about all your research and what you guys have been up to at Auburn. But just moving on to some personal life interest, I've seen some pretty rad photos of you hooked up on a fly rod on a variety of different types of fish. And I've seen some pictures of some really beautiful native black bass species that you've caught. So what does a typical day of fishing with Hank sort of look like? What do you like to target? What are some techniques that you typically gravitate towards?
Man, I love fly fishing. I love the tactics of it. You know, there are a lot of ways to get technical with conventional gear as well, but it seems like I can get into skinnier water, and some of these red-eye bass streams that we get into are, 6 feet wide, and You can hardly cast a fly rod, but when you can flick a little popper into an eddy and hook up with something that looks like a coral reef fish. It's crazy how beautiful some of the long ears and the red eye are here. You know, growing up in New Jersey, I didn't really have any interest in fishing because all the creeks are full of trash. And, you know, in my area, there are plenty of streams in New Jersey that still have, native brook trout and everything. But where I grew up specifically, there wasn't really much opportunity to recreate. So I got into fly fishing in college, and when I got down here and I realized there were opportunities to do it here, I linked up with some of the guides and they showed me the ropes, and now I've got a canoe, and Amy and I like to float some of the bigger rivers and their tributaries, but we really just like to paddle down to a shoal and just get out on the rocks and cast and pick it apart.
That's super cool. Yeah, I know it can be hard to recreate in Iowa sometimes. Fly fishing is my go-to if I like to fish, and I typically like to fish moving systems as opposed to lakes or anything, because I've just never been a boat guy. But it's also hard when you're 3 hours from your study area, which has all the trout. But yeah, some of the most fun I've ever had with a fly rod is using tiny poppers and catching sunfish all day. So I think your fish art is so awesome because it's different and it's kind of fun. And I don't mean to belittle it by saying it's fun, like it's not serious, because I've seen some of your Sunday fish sketches and, you know, they can be very technical and classic. But, you know, I remember a couple of ones in particular where you like combined a brown trout with an alligator, or had something about like a, I don't know, it looked like a bull trout or like an Arctic char or something drinking out of a wine glass.
Yeah.
What was your past, you know, becoming an illustrator or designer? You know, did you just wake up one day with a desire to create something, or how did you stumble upon that?
I've always doodled, and I've always kind of doodled with a sense of humor, I guess. I didn't really start taking my art seriously until people started telling me I was kind of good at it. I was like, oh, maybe I should kind of practice and pay attention to how to actually do it right. So I started just participating in Sunday Fish Sketch. Honestly, Renee just gave me a reason to dedicate some time to it every day or every week and just focus on it. And I started realizing that different media were fun to work with. I started in pencils and pens and then markers and then paint. You know, I realized that I could communicate what these fish are supposed to look like with art, and then I realized, well, I could also have some fun with it and paint some kind of puns. You know, a lot of, you mentioned the gator brown, a lot, you know, every fly fisherman has a slang term for a giant specimen of their favorite species, and everybody's always after those gator browns down in North Carolina and everything. So I figured, you know, it'd be kind of funny if you put a gator head on a brown trout head on a gator's body. But yeah, I mean, I realized that I like doing it, and I could get people excited about certain species just by representing them well or in a funny, cool way. And that gave me some opportunities to do some illustration for people. Yeah, I've done some scientific figures, and I've done some design work, like logo work or for stickers and things like that. And I like it all. You know, I'm trying to get into more serious art now. I've been doing some acrylic painting and trying to find a teacher to learn how to paint in oils, because that's a little more challenging. But I still enjoy, you know, just doing the little fun sticker designs and stuff on my iPad.
Yeah, for sure. My brother was the one with the art degree, so I was always the less inclined brother to try and do artistic stuff, because I sucked at it. But you mentioned Sunday Fish Sketch, which I think is like a really cool way that I've seen, you know, people from all over the country and the world sort of just put aside some time every week to, you know, participate in something fun that's not necessarily work or science, but it's sort of still, as you said, science communication. Or at least, yeah, just appreciation for a cool or lesser known of fish. So I've done a few. They're not as good as everyone else's, but it is just a fun thing that I've been involved with. So
that's what I love about it. It's so low stakes. You know, it's not like, look at me, look how awesome I am at art. It's just like, hey, let's all participate in this fun theme and see what ideas we can come up with. You know, some people are kind of overachievers and they'll spend all week on their Sunday fish sketch and come up with a masterpiece. And some people are just doodling on bar napkins. And, you know, I've seen little doodles with funny captions get way more likes on Twitter than a colored pencil piece that took, you know, 90 hours of shading.
Right.
But it's just cool to see so many different people participating and not worrying about, oh, people are going to think I suck at art if I draw this, you know, goldfish and crayon. No, nobody cares. Everybody just wants to see you participate and celebrate the fish.
That's one of my stipulations, is on weeks that I do it, which I need to, you know, get back into doing it regularly. But one of the things, like, I only set aside the Sunday to do it. But do you have any personal favorite products or something that you sort of sticks out as one that you would like to hang on every wall of apartment or house that you live in?
I love it when people are stoked about the red eye paintings. It's a really special fish. And I mean, it gets a lot of attention in my community just because we all know what it is. But,
right,
you know, if you went to Michigan and told them, hey, check out this bass, they'd be like, oh, yeah, that's a rock bass. And they wouldn't really know, you know, just how diverse the different phenotypes are and how beautiful they are and where they live, too. I mean, you could live in Alabama your whole life and never see some of these places. And if you saw a picture of it, you would never think that it was in Alabama.
Right.
Especially in the Piedmont and the Highland regions. But yeah, I mean, I've been working on trying to highlight some black bass diversity with my art, and it's getting some attention, which is fun. And I'm just hoping to get more reference pictures, because some of these species are impossible to find pictures of, because nobody knows what they are.
Yeah. Or maybe they're lumped into red-eye bass, because I know there's some that are very rare species of native black bass in the Southeast, and they're not necessarily the easiest thing to distinguish between.
Yeah, there's a new study starting out of UGA. Marty Hamill is heading it up on Swanee bass. Have you heard of those?
Yeah, I've seen some NAMFA posts about it and stuff like that.
Yeah, they're unreal. Amy did some work with them while she was at Georgia DNR, and man, they are just so cool looking. They're like Tallapoosa bass on steroids. They get like 4 or 5 pounds, and they just get really deep bodied. Their heads look disproportionately small, but they get these amazing blue and gold hues on them. It's like, I haven't been able to paint one yet because I need more reference pictures. But
yeah,
Marty, if you're listening, send me some photos.
Yeah, send them over, because we all benefit from your work. Well, I guess it's time that we transition. We have a couple of closing questions that we ask each of our guests. Most people say that it's the hardest one to answer, but what is your favorite fish?
I listened to the last couple of podcasts, and every time you come to this question, I'm like, all right, I'm going to have a good answer for him. He's not going to stump me. My favorite fish is the American paddlefish, because nothing makes me happier than showing somebody who's never heard of a paddlefish a picture of a paddlefish. Introducing people to that species, it is so fun, because they look at it and they're just like, how is that a real animal? It's like how those biologists who discovered the platypus were like, this is a joke, right? they tried to pull it off. Yeah, they were like, why does this beaver have a duck bill? This is insane. That's exactly how people feel about the paddlefish the first time they see it. It's like, man, that lives in fresh water? That looks like a dinosaur.
Yeah, and then if they see a picture of the rostrum, you know, with all the cartilage and stuff removed, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Nick Kramer is listening to this smiling, because he is absolutely a paddlefish enthusiast, to say the least. So
how can you not be, you know?
Yeah, true. Very true. So you're working at Auburn on your PhD. So what is your dream job or location for afterwards?
My dream job would be to have access to as much telemetry data as possible. Doesn't really matter where. I'm cool with really anywhere. I've lived in a lot of different places, and you know, I didn't think I was going to like it in Cleveland. I didn't think I was going to like it in Alabama. I was wrong both times. I'm pretty adaptable, but as long as I've got a lot of data to work with, I find that to be extremely fulfilling, is when I can look at a huge data set and pull out interesting patterns or help somebody else with their analysis. That makes me really happy. So
yeah,
I've kind of got my eyes set on GLaDOS, the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System.
Yeah.
Those guys do some really amazing work with an enormous array. Like I actually deployed some of the receivers when I worked on Lake Erie I did not know how vast the array really was and how far they're tracking some of these lake sturgeon and walleye, but that's probably where I'd look first for a dream job is up there.
It's funny you mentioned that. Dan Eiserman from the co-op unit at Stevens Point actually just gave a seminar at Iowa State last Friday talking about, you know, basically a review of all of their walleye movement information, and he talked about some other species that they have tagged and how the arrays are set up, and it is absolutely enormous, you know, the amount of data that they have, the amount of transmitters that they've put in fish, and all of the receivers that they have. It is like you said, if you're looking for a big data set, that might be a good place to look.
Yeah, definitely.
And lastly, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed in everyone's head, what would that be?
I had some interesting conversations with some folks in Canada last week about imposter syndrome and how we measure ourselves as scientists. And Rob Lennox said something interesting to me. He said, you know, maybe we shouldn't really all be worrying about achievement, but we should be worrying about competence. Let's just make sure we know our stuff really well and be confident in that and not worry about, you know, who won best student paper or who got the grant that we wanted, or, you know, because especially on Twitter, it's really easy to measure yourself against everyone else when you're constantly bombarded with, oh, I'm honored and pleased to announce that I've accepted this, or I was awarded this. And while it's great to celebrate each other, I think for a lot of early career researchers and grad students, it can be overwhelming to be exposed to that all the time and feel like, well, what have I accomplished lately? And I think that if everybody could just take a deep breath and realize what they're an expert in, you know, and even if you don't think you're an expert, realize that you know one thing at least better than anybody else in the world, and if you can figure out what that is and feel good about that, then I think you're on your way to gaining more confidence as a scientist, because really what's important is knowing your stuff and not being celebrated or decorated, because awards are just awards. But I think that if everybody just focused on their own competence and their own knowledge of their own subjects, that would probably put people in a better sort of mental headspace and worry less about being an imposter in their field.
That's a perfect message, and especially for, like you said, early career professionals and graduate students. And something I always try and remember is that, when I was finishing up at Clemson, Brandon Peoples once told me that people make bad measuring sticks. And I've always remembered that phrase. And so it's really neat that you bring up that point. Well, thank you, Hank, for a great interview. And thank you all for tuning into today's episode. I do want to remind everyone about the Patreon page. And if you all feel inclined to go on over and help us out, you can go to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast to become a sponsor and get yourself some cool Fish Pod merch. If you'd like to get a hold of any of the hosts, you can find us on Twitter at fisheriespod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I'm Brett Kelly. Thank you for listening to the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, worry about your own competency and not necessarily your achievements. And know that